What is it, shark? No, I don't want to see your new material. You're a shark. You swim, you eat, you attack, you jump out of the water. That's it. Shark Week has been going since 1988, and frankly, the whole concept is on its downward slope. People, you know, they're tired of you. That's kind of the elephant in the room. No, there's not an actual elephant in the room. That's an expression. So much you don't understand. Yeah, you know what else you don't understand? Show business. Nielsen ratings. Overexposure. You know who people really want to see? Giant squids. Yeah, I know you find that upsetting, but giant squids, nobody ever sees them. Meanwhile, you can't swing a cat these days without hitting one of you idiots. No, that's another expression. I'm not swinging a cat. You know, I'm starving, and there's nothing to eat here. No cat, no elephant, and we're not making a video, so just beat it, would you? Don't sulk. That's very unattractive in a man-eating predator. Meanwhile, the rest of us will listen to The Nose, which is about Robin Williams, comment threads, and the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge. And now, the guy who turned down the chance to manage Dory, Marlin, and Nemo before they got cast in the movie, Colin McEnroe.
That's true. They were in my office. I can remember it like it was yesterday. They were in my office, and I said to them, no one is going to make a movie about clownfish. So just forget about it. No one is ever going to make a movie about clownfish. Now, technically, I think Dory is not a clownfish. I think he's a regal tang. But anyway, you understand the point I was making. They went away dejected. And, of course, I lost a lot of money on that. I should have been managing them. All right. That's the end, however, of our piscine or aquatic talk, because we discussed at one point possibly maybe talking about shark fatigue. The fact that Shark Week has been going on so long, since 1988, that people are really tired of it. Even with Sharknado, you can't really get sharks to do that many things that you haven't seen before. However, there's other pressing things. And it turns out also one of our guests, Carolyn Payne, still really likes Shark Week. And actually, if you'd seen Carolyn's newest bathing suit, you'd understand the other reason why we're not talking sharks today. Anyway, that's a long story. Anyway, Carolyn Payne is with us today. She's a comedian, writer, dance impresario, three or four other things I'm not thinking of. And Rand Cooper is here with us today. He is a gourmand, an author, an essayist, a critic, and three or four other things I'm not thinking of. Tanisha Dugan was going to be with us today. She can't make it. We're going to struggle along with just the three of us. It means we can all talk more, which actually everybody involved with the show today feels okay about, although we do miss Tanisha. And I hope she's listening right now. So the question was, I mean, it's been a long week of sort of encomiums and talk about Robin Williams. Is there anything left to say? Although yesterday, obviously, there was a new development, which was we started to learn a little bit more about the predicament in which Robin Williams found himself. He was early on with a diagnosis of Parkinson's disease, and that seems to have influenced his thinking. In fact, Rand, you told me an interesting story via email today, which was somebody that you know. You probably don't want to say what his name was, but somebody who's a medical professional kind of guessed that something like that might have been in the offing somehow.
Right. He's a doctor who deals with celebrities frequently, and I don't know if he had any inside information. I don't think he particularly did. I don't think he knew Robin Williams personally, but he said, I heard via a friend that this guy had said, you know, there's something else going on here. I'm guessing that he has had some devastating medical diagnosis, and that was I think on Wednesday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, and then I didn't hear the actual news until today.
You know, Carolyn, one of the things that I've been thinking a lot about, and I listened to the Mark Maron interview with Robin Williams, and just turning all this stuff over in my mind is whether, and we should say that Carolyn is about to join Hannibal Buress on the Oddball Tour that came into Hartford rather ingloriously with Dave Chappelle last year. And she's also about to go out and do some work with Second City. It makes me wonder whether comedians are different. Like, listening to Mark Maron and Robin Williams have this very on-team conversation, often kind of invoking names and ideas and terms of art that wouldn't necessarily be familiar to the average person. It made me realize that comedians, like firefighters, like oceanographers, like a lot of other people, I mean, they live in their own specific world, but they also mine a lot of stuff in themselves in very specific ways. And Mark Maron obviously minds it for melancholy a lot of the time. Robin Williams mind it for other things. It makes you wonder, you know, are these different people? Are they really people who would maybe process a piece of news like Parkinson's disease or something else in a different way?
I absolutely think so. I know I think a lot of times the root of comedy, I know even for myself, a lot of things that I take and turn into a set or turn into writing is the darker stuff, and you're kind of making light of it. And it's a coping mechanism. I mean, that's just a well-known way that humans deal, is to laugh and to find a way to cope. So, and I think that how every comedian processes that and how they present themselves. I mean, like you said, Mark Maron, I feel like he uses his general melancholy and all of his sadness and frustrations in life is just his whole shtick. Whereas Robin Williams had this very cheery, you know, frenetic energy persona where it was just this constant he was just constantly moving and he just constantly had this energy. So it's very hard to picture someone like that just kind of stopping and not having that energy. But behind that energy was this real darkness. Obviously.
Yeah. I have to, first of all, tip my hat, as I so often do, to friend and colleague Mike Pesca, who on his podcast, The Gist, I couldn't have been more than 4 or 5 days, if that, before the Robin Williams, the announcement of Robin Williams' death. Maybe it was a little bit more because I don't always listen to them in a timely fashion. But he devoted about 16 to 20 minutes to a conversation about comedians and mental illness and comedians struggling with various kinds of demons and seeking treatment or not seeking treatment. It was just wound up being a very prescient podcast. But, you know, the common thread, Rand, with all these guys, and it really came out on Pesca's show, was that question of losing your edge. All right, your edge. And one of the things that comedians said repeatedly, there were a bunch of comedians who were interviewed or quoted on the show, was that they were reluctant to seek treatment sometimes for their depression or their other mental illnesses because they were afraid, just in the same way that Carolyn was kind of describing. What if I lose my edge? What if I'm happier, but that really deprive? I mean, something that a cellist probably wouldn't have to go through. But with a comedian, that question of your mood, you know, actually is your art in some ways.
I have two thoughts about that with regard to Williams. And given the news that's come out in the past day or two about the Parkinson's, you sort of are left with the set of thoughts you had about Williams' suicide before that and the somewhat different set of thoughts you have now. Before the Parkinson's news came out, it occurred to me to think, you know, Williams' kind of comedy was something that took a lot out of him physically. He wasn't like the Jerry Seinfeld kind of comedian, and I love Jerry Seinfeld, who has these bits and he works through the bits meticulously and he tries them out and he corrects them and he makes them funnier. Williams's comedy was much more of a performance art, and this manic riffing that he did, at times represented or resembled a kind of borderline, you know, mental or emotional unbalance. I mean, it was the manic side of a manic depressive personality.
Just watching him sweat on stage.
Watching him sweat. You know, this is a kind of thing that, especially as you get to be 60, I mean, can you really get your body up for that up to that level of performance that his kind of manic energy required? That was my first thought. After the Parkinson's came out, I found myself thinking about Michael J. Fox and how he has dealt with Parkinson's and the courage and brilliance that he has that he's shown in turning that to performance advantage. You know, I happened to watch him I didn't watch that show that he did a couple of years ago, but I've seen him in The Good Wife, and he brilliantly uses his Parkinson's to help create a really obnoxious character who you dislike in part because he's manipulatively using his Parkinson's. And every time I see that performance, I think, man, A, are you a courageous human? And B, are you really a genius actor? It's a little harder to imagine Robin Williams having used his Parkinson's that way. Parkinson's eventually reduces you, as we've seen with Muhammad Ali, to the situation in which the cognitive person is largely there, but you are expressionless. And for a Robin Williams to be rendered incrementally more and more expressionless, and to not have, you know, control over all those voices he did, his performances were always often a kind of a series of sequence of interesting masks that allowed him to be something other than himself. Parkinson's does that in this dreadful way, and I don't know what to say about how awful that must seem to him.
Actually, now that you're talking that way, you know, required reading really for this conversation should have been Michael Kinsley, who also has Parkinson's disease, did a really interesting piece in The New Yorker, I think about 4 months ago, would you say? And it was about his mental edge. And is he losing his mental edge? And it was all done in a very witty Kinsleyan fashion. But he talked about various kinds of tests that he'd taken. And there are tests that ultimately do come as close as possible to testing your mental agility and your mental acuity. And it was sort of about all of our anxieties, particularly as baby boomers, as we age. You know, what kind of edge are we losing? As we go along here, by the way, 860-275-7266 is a number that you could call if you wanted to add to this conversation, 860-275-7266. So, Carolyn, you know, as this kind of week has unfolded, all these different stories, of course, surfaced. And I had missed it the first time around. Today, I caught up with this kind of tweet storm that the comedian Norm Macdonald did. Have you seen that one?
Yeah.
It's just this amazing story about the fact that he was about to go on David Letterman for the first time, a relatively unsung performer. He's all alone in the dressing room, seems to be kind of a deserted floor of the building, you know, well before the show. He's on his phone to his friend, and he sees Robin Williams walk by, and he's going to be following Robin Williams. He already feels very disadvantaged because he feels Williams is the best comedian in the world. He sees Robin Williams walk by. He mentions that to his friend. Williams hears his name, pivots around, and comes back into the dressing room and immediately starts to dress Norm Macdonald or pretend to dress Norm Macdonald as a Jewish tailor. And he's asking him in this, you know, hyper-pronounced accent if he, quote, addresses left or right, and buzzing around him and fussing with his clothes and doing this comedy routine. And finally, Norm Macdonald says, "Can you talk to my friend? Because my friend is on the phone with me and he's not going to believe this." Williams takes the phone and immediately becomes someone at a Chinese restaurant taking the friend's order and for 10 minutes talking about what they're out of and what they can't have. And then the phone goes back and he goes back to Norm Macdonald. He turns back into the Jewish tailor. He dresses Norm Macdonald. He actually does dress him and tie his tie in a Windsor knot and then disappears. And one of the things – I mean, there's so much there in that – just in that little anecdote. But sort of to Rand's point – and I saw Williams when he was on the set of The World According to Garp. And similarly, what should have been some downtime for him, he was pacing back and forth, performing for everybody. And some comedians say, that's the real me. Forget how I am if I'm just sitting in my house and on a couch talking to a couple of people or something. That's sort of not the real me. The real me actually is that person. And you get that feeling with Williams that, you know, that's maybe even in the Marc Maron interview, he seems very relaxed and almost a little drowsy at times. And then he just veers off into shtick pretty quickly. He can't tell a story without doing six different voices. And maybe that he felt like that's the real me.
Absolutely. I think that became clear. One of the things when, you know, a celebrity passes away, like, you know, there's all this public mourning because we feel like we know them. And sometimes when a celebrity passes away, it's when you get to know them even more because you're hearing all these never heard before stories, all these, you know, untold little anecdotes, private moments. And that's kind of how I felt like I was getting to know Robin Williams this week for the first time. And it turns out like he was pretty much what he was. What you saw was what you were getting. You know, there was another very sweet story about the girl who played his daughter in Mrs. Doubtfire and how he went to bat for her. And she wrote a great article about that. But I think Robin Williams really was Robin Williams. Like I'm meeting him in person. I never got to, but I'm sure like anybody can say he just was constantly on and performing, which is exactly I'm the opposite of that. I'm one of those people who, you know, if you aren't dangling, you know, with a carrot of money to perform, I'm not going to be like a little monkey and do a dance for you and get up there and make you laugh. But he just genuinely just had all of this inside of him, and that was just how he interacted.
Well, you know, grieving for a public figure, a celebrity, it's a fascinating topic. You don't really know that person, as you said. So it's not the same at all as grieving the loss of someone you knew. You're grieving some sort of fantasy that you have concocted through inference and imagination about who that person might be. And the person that we came up with through that process with Robin Williams was always someone who we thought was generous and kind. And that's partly, I think, because his kind of comedy lacked the sort of acid, misanthropic quality that many comedians sometimes necessarily have. There was nothing – he didn't tear down other people with his humor. The person he tore down was often himself. And so, you know, when the girl from Mrs. Doubtfire writes that article and she says he was an incredibly kind human being, you sort of think, well, you know, I somehow suspected that about him. I do think the other reason perhaps we suspected that is I think when you said, you know, what you saw with him was what you got. There were these two Robin Williams. I mean, I think of him as the one actor that I always look forward to seeing on a Letterman or another late night show. A lot of actors, they're out there, you know, flacking their latest product, and it's really hideous and boring. But with Williams, you could count on something good was going to happen. And he was going to zoom off on one of these wild tangents. Speed was always the defining characteristic of his improvisation. You know, speed, spontaneity, association. And there was that Williams, and it sort of half of his movies were designed to showcase that Williams, like Good Morning Vietnam. But then he did these other – increasingly did these other movies that almost seemed designed to tell you, you know, I'm not just that Robin Williams. I can play a ruthless killer, you know, as he did in that film with Al Pacino, you know, in The Darkness, what's that called?
Insomnia.
Yeah, Insomnia. Or this demented guy working in the photo department of the store, One-Hour Photo, I think it was called, who develops this obsession with a family and their photos. But then there were those films where he played sort of the soulful, sorrowful person whose eyes were almost brimming with tears of empathy, like in Moscow and Hudson and
Goodwill Hunting.
Goodwill Hunting, mm-hmm. Jacob the Liar, in a way. And even if he allowed or managed to smuggle in a few moments of the manic Williams, like in Dead Poets Society is a great film because it has both of them. You know, he does like the riffing Shakespeare as done by Marlon Brando. But then there's like the, you know, the Williams who's got that brimming eye look, and he's giving these kids this great advice for life. So I think he was effective at conveying that other Williams to us, and we accepted it. We accepted it.
I'm going to grab a call from Marianne, and well, actually, I'll just grab that call. It may lead to where I wanted to go. Anyway, here's Marianne in Danbury. Hi.
Hi. I'm just listening, and I always watch to listen. But all this talk since his passing, which was horrible, it just strikes me that everyone's trying to look for an answer to make themselves feel better. And, you know, sometimes, I mean, my first thought was, oh, God, you know, anybody who's depressed was thinking, geez, could I ever deteriorate to that level? And it's frightening. And I remember Jane Pauley saying on CBS the next day, the suicide control lines lit up. And, you know, it's like we're all looking for an answer, but I don't think, you know, some things just, you can't make sense of them.
All right, yeah, I would agree. And I think that's a fruitless quest. Although, I mean, just to go back to what we were saying before about comedy, and Carolyn Rand mentioned at one point Jerry Seinfeld. You know, Seinfeld, and I didn't really realize this until listening to Pesca's show, Seinfeld apparently feels and has said that he feels a little ostracized, a little stigmatized, a little left out of things because he is the comedian who does not have any evident psychic distress. That, you know, that he's not in treatment, he hasn't needed treatment, he's been asked a lot of questions. Howard Stern grilled him about this at one point and saying, I bet you hated your parents or something like that. You just, you know, come on, tell me what it is. That they're actually – and that Seinfeld really is this – kind of rare bird that they're, you know, all the people that he knows, you know, all the Richard Lewis's and Larry David's and the are messes in one way or another, which is kind of, it's an interesting commentary on the profession anyway.
Well, I mean, I've been open on this show talking about, I'm a very anxious person. I have a lot of anxieties. I mean, it's not to the point where it's crippling by any means, but I think that those anxieties are a lot of who I am as a performer and a lot of what I can take to work with. And because people like that when they can identify with you. And I think a lot of times with comedy, a big thing of things that are funny are people identifying, being like, yes, I'm afraid of that too. Yes, I hate that too. Oh my God, I sit around worrying about that. Yes, I look up rashes on WebMD too. Like all these things that then people, it helps you connect. And in some ways for me, it ends up being therapeutic because you're connecting and you realize like, oh, okay, I'm not that weird. So,
by the way, the Mayo Clinic site is much better for rashes.
Okay, I'll keep that in mind.
WebMD, I don't think is that good.
Yeah, WebMD, I should really stay off of that. I should block it from my browser, actually.
Let me just say, it's for lightweight hypochondriacs. The serious people, we go right to the Mayo Clinic. They've got all the same information, but it just has a little bit more reliable standard.
I sympathize with Seinfeld's comment, and yeah. I think it sheds a light on how much we tend to link the idea of creative inspiration to the idea of to a messed up childhood, to unhappiness,
anguish,
and that only the person who has suffered, who has been marginalized and excluded in some regard, and particularly unhappy in childhood, is the likely future creator of excellence. And that's not just true for comedians. Mm-hmm. I think it's very true with writers. We live in a culture in which the memoir of family dysfunction is almost like, you know, the necessary key to the domain for almost any writer who wants to get in there.
I'm always haunted by a letter exchange between E.B. White and James Thurber, who combine both the writing, as you say, and the humor. And they're writing back and forth, and they're talking about how miserable they are. They're both, in different ways, very miserable people. Thurber probably a lot more miserable than White, but White a very unhappy man and an anxious man in a lot of ways. And they're talking about that, and they're saying, is this necessary? You know what I mean? Do we have to? And then they talk about Robert Benchley, a comic writer who's sort of a slightly different generation. He's a little bit older than either one of them. And one of them says, look at Benchley. He laugh. He sing. They talk about him as this sort of guy who seems to have escaped this whole curse. But mm-hmm. it is, you just get a window, and this is something people do talk about and wonder how endemic it is to creativity. All right, we've got to take a quick break here. We've got two other topics we're going to tackle here. We'd love to get your phone calls, not on this topic anymore, but on others as we go along here today, because we're down a panelist. That might make some room for you to call in. Well, the news is usually a merry affair, and right now we're going from Parkinson's disease to ALS, which I realize sounds a little grim, but there's sort of it's an interesting cultural baggage that goes along with this, too. One of the things we're always interested in is how something becomes viral. Why does something spread? Why does something become incredibly popular in this proving ground of the internet? So one of the things that has done that is this thing called the Ice Bucket Challenge. It seems to have started among athletes. It's spread everywhere. The notion basically is that you take an ice bucket of water and dump it over your head. If you're challenged to do this and you're not willing to do it, you give $100 to the fight against ALS. So this is not a purely theoretical and speculative conversation for at least one of the people sitting here, Carolyn Payne. You've actually done this. So tell us a little bit more about your own experience with it, and that'll I should say where we're going with it, which is that not everybody likes this. And there are people, including people pretty close to the ALS community, who are saying, really, isn't there a better way to raise money and raise awareness than to put people through this? And the ice bucket kind of becomes the story instead of the fight against the disease. But tell us about your experience.
All right. I agreed to do this for a couple of reasons. It started out in Boston. I'm a native to Boston. So I had been seeing this on Facebook because it started, like you said, from athletes. And I knew it was only a matter of time before I got tagged in it. And I, you know, debated to myself, oh, will I do it? And, you know, I ended up kind of researching it to make sure that and I got tagged by a little buddy of mine. He's 13 years old, and he also put on the stipulation that not only was he tagging me to do it, but he wanted to throw the ice bucket on my head. So if you see the video of me, I'm getting doused in ice water by a 13-year-old who then obnoxiously gets in my face and is like, ha ha, in a very, very fitting way. But to me, there were personal reasons that I wanted to do this, as a lot of people participating in it have personal reasons. But, you know, it's summer. Like, it's ice water. A lot of people are like, oh, I don't want to have to – it's hot out. I think this would have a lot more meaning if this went around in, like, January. And I think that that would be amazing. And then you're really getting to separate the mice from the men, so to speak. But I just think it's a great way to spread awareness. And I know it's very gimmicky and everything, but I did stress, like, when I did it and shared it, donate too. Don't just do it and do this for, you know, to go for glory, because I see a lot of that. Like, you see girls out there just doing this so that they have an excuse to video themselves in a sports bra getting wet on Facebook and spread it around. But I think it's a good thing when anything can help spread awareness of something, raise a ton of money as this has, and get people to at least think about doing good and thinking about things that they can do that can go viral and help spread good for other causes.
To how many people did you then subsequently? Because this thing functions as kind of a chain letter, right? It's a it's like a chain letter in a couple of ways. One of the ways is there's a kind of if you don't, you know.
Right. You're basically sort of threatening your friends that you're extorting their money if they don't want to get wet.
So how many people did you tag?
Three, one of whom was Kyone. Still waiting on that.
Right. So I've been challenged and tagged by somebody else too. Somebody I don't even really know, which I also have some strange thoughts about. But Rand, I'd be interested to know your general thoughts about this.
I have a set of incoherent and baffled thoughts. But I'll just say personally, I would hate to do this. The thought of having a bucket of ice water dumped over my head, I don't like being startled. I think I'll have a heart attack.
You know it's coming.
You know, no, but I mean, no. But the physical sensation of this suddenly happening is like being startled emotionally. But it's your body is being startled. You know it's happening mentally. But I hate the thought of it. I do think that anything that Tom Foley is doing to kick off his campaign, you know, probably is something that has seriously jumped the shark, to use our earlier metaphor. So I wonder about that. I would say, you know, there are two difficulties. First of all, I'll say my mother-in-law died 3 years ago of ALS. So I know a lot about ALS, and I understand the particular agonies that it involves. And a good friend of mine died of it years ago, and it lasted for a very long time. And the process of dying that way, it's really one of the worst ways to die. So there's an inherent unusual gravity and agony that attaches to this. And that creates a jangling dissonance, and I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just noting this, with the sort of larkish-like hijinks of this stunt. So I think one thing that is interesting to try to make sense of is, you know, is there some way that they can go together other than by saying, hey, look, this is raising money and raising awareness. I mean, what if, you know, what – Colin, help me out here. Like you could put together a lot of things that are so dissonant, but they're serving a good function.
Right.
How do you make sense of that?
Well, see, I think that's a thing. I think that's a motif, and it's maybe something more than that. This thing has its roots in a whole bunch of other things. It really almost goes back to if you go to your school fair, one of the teachers will be sitting in some kind of dunking mechanism where if you throw the ball, the teacher gets dropped into the water, and often that's raising money for the PTA or something like that. And guys, situations where guys challenge each other to shave their heads or something like that, again, for a good cause. And this ALS thing, I mean, I absolutely understand what a horrible disease this is, and I salute the fact that it did. First of all, the thing to say is it worked. I think one of the major ALS groups say they've raised an extra $2.3 million doing this. So it worked. There are complaints about the fact that a lot of times the celebrities do it. They don't even mention ALS. But overall, it worked. And here's my theory, Ryan. I think that it's a really horrible theory in some ways. I think all of these things are ways in which we kind of link some of our otherwise unexpressible hostility and desire to sort of see what each other, you know, go through discomfort or things like that to a really good cause. It's like if I said I wanted to dump ice water over your head for no reason, that would sort of obviously be kind of an aggressive and hostile act. But it's completely redeemed because it's linked to this very important cause. And I think we do – I mean, I'm not saying that everybody who does this is really expressing, you know, some kind of deep anger. But there is something a little aggressive. I mean, when this random guy that I didn't know on Facebook said, oh, well, I'm challenging you to dump – I'm thinking, well, why are you doing that? Why don't you just challenge me to give $100 to ALS, which I would really rather do. And why is this ice water thing part of this conversation, except that you probably think it would be kind of amusing in a very, you know, prankish and possibly –
this is probably some guy who was on a comment thread, right, anticipating our next one of your comment threads. You know, but I will say, I mean, my very personal understanding of this is when I think about my mother-in-law whom I loved. And she certainly sometimes felt like dumping a bucket of ice water on my head. And so if I were to do this, I would be doing it saying, all right, Kathy, this is for you because you probably wanted to do this at certain points.
All right. I don't want to give short shrift to this topic, but we do have to sort of move on because our final topic is about comment threads. So the Gawker media empire this week had a real problem with their comment threads, which involved people uploading really horrible stuff. It's possible because of their platform to put GIFs and other kinds of stuff up, and the things that were going up were really horrible. So, but Gawker loves comments. So all those Gawker entities like Gawker, Jezebel, Deadspin, stuff like that, they work off comments. So they need to fix that glitch and keep the comments going. But this prompted a pretty thoughtful essay in a publication called the Pacific Standard, where they haven't gotten rid of comment threads because they're just so awful and filled with trolls. So this, I don't know, this has led us in all kinds of different directions. But Carolyn, one of the things you pointed out to us was the website of an Australian radio station. This is earlier this summer, where somebody had posted a recipe for making frozen rainbow cake that had numbers on it. It was entirely...
It's like a Pinterest cake. It's rainbow on the outside with like fondant and rainbow on the inside. I mean, it's the kind of thing that literally, like, it would take less time to drive to another state and buy a cake than it would to sit and make this cake. You know, it's one of those nightmare-inducing Pinterest things that you get roped into.
It's called Amazing Rainbow Tie-Dye Number Surprise Cake.
Yeah, it even takes way too long to say. But it ended up – the comments went from questions about how to make this to political discussions. I mean, it just – I think the website calls it the apocalypse of comment section or the world or something. I mean, it was so –
People began insulting each other on multiple bases.
Right.
You know, where they were from, what kind of parent they were, what kind of – what their politics were, whether they understood what words meant.
The way that it escalated is just outrageous. It took about 10 comments for this just to become horrifying. And I think this to me was the penultimate in example of comment threads just being awful. Like, just get rid of them. I've seen it on my own personal Facebook. And I did a web series for a while. I was doing this like comedy science news web series. And we launched the first episode on YouTube, and there were like 12 comments within the first 2 days, and most of them made me want to sit in a room and cry. Like, it was people just attacking. And I remember the producer of it saying, just don't worry about it. We don't feed the trolls. But it's hard to not and it was ridiculous things that people go after. So I'm a firm believer. Just get rid of it.
Just shut it off. Our number, by the way, 860-275-7266. You will not be shut off. But don't be a troll. 860-275-7266. You may tweet us. Our tweetmaster, Greg Hill, isn't in today, but he may be tweeting. I'm not sure. At WNPR Colin. Whether he's here or not, obviously, you may tweet at us at WNPR Colin. Rand, I know this is something you've thought a lot about, and you occasionally do write things that get comments. So where do your thoughts go?
I noticed a week or so ago one of the parents of one of the Newtown kids wrote a piece about Newtown Sandy Hook deniers.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd been away when this was written. And when I came back, I went online and saw it, and I was interested in reading the comments. And I saw there were no comments, which means that the current closed down the comment section. Now, listeners will know that many places like while the New York Times is able to afford a staff of people who moderate discussions and therefore keep it civil – Papers like The Current can't afford that. So they tried a number of years ago to use Facebook, the idea being that, oh, if you're a real person connected to a Facebook site, you're less likely to spew toxic stuff on, you know, on a comment. And it toned it down a little bit, but it didn't take care of the problem. So as soon as I saw that, and there were no comments posted in that article, I knew that deniers had gotten on and said really, really awful things. To me, this has often been a source of despair and about who we are as a culture of civil conversers. And also sometimes, you know, it's freaked me out. I mean, I wrote some pieces about gun control, and I tried my best both to set them up and to address the responders in a way that would encourage a civil conversation. But inevitably, a number of people got on who really scared me, actually. And when one of them figured out where I lived and started mailing stuff to my house, I honestly thought, all right, you know what? I'm never writing a piece like this again because it's not worth it. I mean, it actually, if you think probabilistically about such things, you know, it actually substantially increased the small possibility that someone shows up and like blows me away or something. So, you know, what for a current op-ed, it's not worth it. You know, the only thing I would say is I pick up on a note of Collins. Collins, in one of your emails, you said, I remember when all of this was first possible and how exciting it was, you know, to be able to post and comment. And I will say that there is this project whereby you use a thread in order to develop arguments, in order to listen to what other smart people are saying. I mean, this was the initial idea. It's like, oh, I've thought about social or political problem up to point X, and I haven't been able to go beyond that. I want to hear what people are saying about the ideas I've taken to this point because you know what? They've gone beyond that. And that's the situation in which it becomes this group sort of crowdsourcing prospect. But, you know, that whole idealistic project seems to have been swamped in a sea of toxic muck.
What were you going to say?
Well, I just think that and I've talked about this with Twitter. The internet, like, opens the door to this because I feel like people think that they're hiding behind something. People say things online and on Twitter that they would never say. Some people. I mean, some people will just flat out say that. But a lot of times there's a lot of people who use this as kind of something to hide behind and just blast out just nastiness. And I think that it's interesting because it is such a great forum to have intellectual discussions and to share your thoughts and give yourself – because not everyone has a public forum to discuss things or even sometimes a private forum. You know, it should be a great place to discuss things. But instead, it just takes one person to ruin it for everyone.
One thing I'll add, like chat rooms where there's a dedicated topic where it's not just people sounding off. But let's say like, you know, you're a potter and you're interested in knowing something about the clay or the wheel or, you know, there are plenty of places where people don't just then weigh in saying, you douchebag, you have no idea what you're doing with pottery. No, I mean, I think it's these general opinion forums as opposed to, oh, you know, I'm involved in craft X or I'm into gardening and you know what, I'm pretty bad at it. So I need to find out more stuff. I do think there are these dedicated areas where, guess what, the conversation is still happening in a really productive, collective way.
It's true. If you read the comments on Pinterest, they're usually very positive. You don't find like crazy cat ladies sitting at home attacking each other. They're like, wow, I love your terrarium.
Right. Exactly. I'm going to help you. It's only people who comment on like blogs like Collins where someone expresses an opinion. And then also, you know, there is this general sort of default resentment like, who are you to have an opinion? Who are you, Colin McEnroe, to have an opinion? I've got my opinion. And you're paid for putting yours out there. What makes you better than me? I mean, there is a certain sort of raging populist resentment that that the internet has tossed fuel onto.
This conversation all happens just by coincidence. We planned it earlier on a day when I'm actually having kind of an argument with The Current about this whole question. And so I want to say a few things. First of all, I think one of the things that Rand said is really important that, you know, after his experience writing about the Second Amendment, he sort of didn't want to write pieces like this anymore. And I do think there's a chilling effect. I do know of at least one person who stopped writing opinion pieces for The Current. Because – and I think he would say that somewhere between 40% to 60% of the reason was that these unmoderated comments, which turned into deeply personal and unfounded attacks, they just wore him down. He just didn't want to do it anymore. I struggle with this a lot. I've had guys who did similar kinds of things. I had one guy who researched my life, found out that my father had died of cirrhosis, began taunting me about that on common threads. I've had I think there's another chilling effect that's directed at reasonable commenters. Reasonable commenters go on. They want to join a constructive, interesting back and forth about something, and they're often threatened. They are frequently women. This has happened again and again. I've seen it again and again that a woman commenter will be threatened or taunted, sometimes by another woman commenter, but usually by a man. One of the problems that I have is that the system that exists now in places like the Hartford Courant really privileges the troll over everybody else. I got in trouble today. My latest technique has been to sort of jump onto the comment threads on my articles and just kind of play with the trolls a little bit. And I'll sort of say, really, is that the best you can do? Come on, because I give you an A for really good trolling. But this is sort of a today I have this column up about Robin Williams and Philip Seymour Hoffman and about art and death and madness. And so this guy jumps on and writes, Colin McEnroe for dog catcher. Click. That's his comment. And so I sort of jumped out. I said, really, little troll? Is that the best you can? I mean, you can't even really engage with the material. I'd love to give you a good grade, but it's a D minus for the day. He called the editor and complained that I had been berating him. And so I had to spend some of my day in trouble. And this has happened to me multiple times. Anytime I've jumped in on behalf of a sane and decent commenter, the trolls will often complain about that. And I get called on the carpet. And there has to be a better system. There has to be a better system in which, you know, decent, nice people who want to be in a conversation on a common thread are protected, and people who want to create content are protected, and the trolls aren't. They should be third out of three, not first out of three. And I don't understand how it came to be this other way.
And the solution is it has to be moderated.
Yeah,
you know, but you have to have one person. So the Courant has to pony up and hire someone, some part-time person. Well, it'd have to be a full-time person. But then that would be the person's
job. It's a
lot
of work.
Yeah.
It's a lot of labor. Yeah. Let me grab a call here from Anthony in Prospect. Hi, Anthony.
Hi, how's it going?
Okay.
I have frequent the internet quite often. I don't know if you guys are familiar with a website called Reddit.
Yep.
Okay. It is, you know, a typical website on the internet. There's, of course, your trolls, the people that are just there to make everyone else's day miserable. But there are also a lot of they're what's called subreddits. It's kind of how the website's organized. It's like different interests, things like that. Anyone can create a subreddit for literally anything. I mean, it goes from, you know, r/cooking, which is what they call subreddits, r/ to, you know, r/gardening, to r/funny, just, you know, everything you could possibly imagine. And there's quite a few gems in the website, like one subreddit called r/askhistorian. And what they do is they have most subreddits have a moderation team. It's all volunteer-based. But like Ask Historians, they have what's called their quality contributors, and they're people who are, you know, independently verified to, you know, what they're talking.
So what you're talking about is, and I don't mean to cut you off, but we're sort of low on time, and also your phone's a little distorted. But my sense of Reddit, and I don't do Reddit, although I look at Reddit sometimes. That's a community. It's a self-identified, self-policing, intentional online community where they're trying to achieve a certain thing. And I think the problem with these with legacy media sites is there's no community that really ever develops on the thread of a Hartford Courant article, or maybe even on a New York Times article, although there may be some curating. But it's hard for people to build up a community on a Gawker thread or a series of Gawker threads. So it's, you know, it maybe does take a village to have a civil discussion, but there's no village there. Reddit is a village, you know. They try to do it that way. Why don't we take a break here so we'll have time to endorse when we come back? And that's why I'll read some tweets. We actually have some other people who want to talk about this. If we have time, we'll do that.
Frozen rainbow cake is stupid, and all the idiotic bubble parents who are trying to make it wouldn't know a macaroon from a madeleine. And post. Oh, wait. That was a thread about Obamacare. My bad. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me. Our interns are Josh Nalea and Britt Hill. Greg Hill tweets for us at WNPR Colin, and Katie Tolarski is our executive producer. The part of Bill Curry was played by Tara Reed. For show pages, articles, and videos of the Faith Middleton show staff feeding frozen rainbow cakes to great white sharks, visit our website, WNPR.org. On Monday, we're bringing back origami. And now, back to Colin.
A few big tweets here. Let's see. Bias Galtar. Oh, I like the sort of, what's that called when you reverse? Spoonerism? Is it spoonerism when you reverse the consonants or something?
Yes.
The spoonerism on Battlestar Galactica. I think most of the nonsense speaks to the mass amounts of ignorance and cowards in this world. They have too many outlets now. Living Enough tweets, there's nothing like anonymity to fuel the crazy. And Jacques Lamar, a news panelist himself, says he's instituting the hot male warm cocoa butter challenge to support ALS research. all right, much a kinder and gentler concept. All right, we've got time for endorsements now, so let's do endorsements. And Carolyn, get us started here.
All right. I'm endorsing Two Roads Brewery down in Southern Connecticut. Really fun little day trip to wind out your summer. I can't even believe that summer's ending, that I'm saying things like summer ending. But go enjoy. My endorsement is to go enjoy the last vestiges of summer.
And so what is the actual endorsement?
Two Roads Brewery.
Two Roads Brewery. Where is that?
It's in Stratford.
In Stratford. All right. Two Roads Brewery in Stratford. All right.
Yes.
I have a couple of culinary endorsements. The first is I've been involved in a monthly event at Real Artways in Hartford involving chefs that's been been so popular that they've now extended it for three more episodes. It's called Taste. The next one is a week from Monday. That's the 25th. And the evening involves we watch one in a series of French films about noted French chefs. And then we have a local French chef who does a Q&A and discussion with me about the film afterwards and then cooks for the audience. And a week from Monday, it's Chris Prosperi from Metro Beast, the well-known chef, excellent restaurateur and food personality here in this market. He's also a funny, charming, and very voluble guy. I think there are still some tickets. This event has sold out every single time. It's $25. So that's Taste. You can go to the Real Artways website Monday the 25th. I also want to recommend, and I relatively rarely do this, a restaurant that I reviewed in, of all places, Willimantic, that culinary mecca. It's called Cafe Mantic. It's right on the main street. It opened 5 years ago as a coffee house. It was owned by a young Eastern graduate, a guy named Andrew Goot, who said, this is a college town. There's not even a real coffee house. He opened a coffee house, and 2 years ago, he expanded it into a restaurant. Chef's name is John Hudak, and he worked at Grant's in West Hartford for a number of years. It's a small plates format, very eclectic, everything from lasagna to jerk chicken. But I can say that every single dish I've had in four visits to this place has been fabulous. It's in an old mid-last century building that's been eccentrically rehabbed. If you go to the New York Times and just search for Cafe Mantic, you can see the absolutely rapturous review of this place that I wrote last week. It's really the best.
Can we put comments on it? Is there a comment?
really, if you taste anything there, and John is going to be one of the chefs in the Taste series at Real Artways. So I don't think I've ever been as ecstatic about a restaurant. It's casual. It's not that expensive. And it's just a great place to go. Cafe Mantic.
All right. So I want to endorse – I'm not a big fan of Mark Maron and his podcast, which is called WTF. You can fill out that acronym on your own. And I don't know. I don't know what it is about him that I've never really cottoned to him all that much. But I know he has this huge following and he has this incredible reputation for being able to get in there with people and get people to have conversations that they wouldn't ordinarily have. And I really do have to bow down to him and say, if you have any abiding interest in Robin Williams, you have to listen to this conversation. It is absolutely remarkable. And I would freely concede that Mark Maron and only Mark Maron could have gotten these responses. If you want to hear Robin Williams, probably as close to who he really was as you're ever going to hear him, I would really recommend that you listen to this. And I've been told now there's somebody on email who's sort of guiding me to some other classic, epic Mark Maron conversations, which I will now seek out. I'm somewhat converted anyway. But anyway, and then the last thing I want to say, I want to endorse doing something on Tuesday nights. I said this on Wednesday, but Tuesday nights, boy, they can just drag by, right? They could just like, what do I do? And it's Tuesday night. What do I do? So on Tuesday, September 30th, all I want you to do right now is to circle that date. And I'll give you details later, but we are celebrating the 5th anniversary of the Colin McEnroe Show. We're going to have a big party. All your favorite nose panelists are going to be there. And some of your least favorite nose panelists will also be there. But all kinds of people are going to be there. Grayson Hugh, whom you hear singing in the background, he's going to be there. We'll tell you where it's going to be later. I just want you to save the date, as they say on refrigerator magnets, September 30th. You're invited. If you listen to the show, you're invited to come.
I'm Kyone Wolf here with the Ice Bucket Challenge to raise money for ALS. This is dedicated to my aunt Mariah Gladys, who's been living with ALS since 1981, one of the longest survivors of this disease on the planet. All right, 3, 2, 1.
Ugh. Kyone, you're supposed to break it up into ice cubes before you drop it.
Did you birds donate yet, or what?